better than perfect sense even. It had the feeling of truth, of something that I'd always known and just hadn't ever put into words, or of explaining clearly and plainly something I'd never understood. I was nodding with satisfaction, going along well, and this time I got to the fifth page before I realized again that I couldn't have told anyone what was on the first page, or, for that matter, the page before. I glared down at the book resentfully, and then I opened it to the first page again and started to read out loud, one word at a time. The words sang like birds out of my mouth, beautiful, melting like sugared fruit. I still couldn't keep the train of it in my head, but I kept reading, dreamily, until the door smashed open. I'd stopped barring my door with furniture by then. I was sitting on my bed, which I'd pushed under the window for the light, and the dragon was directly across the room from me, framed in the doorway. I froze in surprise and stopped reading, my mouth hanging open. He was furiously angry. His eyes were glittering and terrible, and he held out a hand and said, "Dwalida Tal!" The book tried to jump out of my hands, to fly across the room to him. I blindly clutched after it, from some badly misguided instinct. It wriggled against me, trying to go, but stupidly obstinate, I gave it a jerk and managed to yank it back into my arms. He gaped at me, and grew even more wildly angry. He stormed across the tiny chamber, while I belatedly tried to scramble up and back, but there was nowhere for me to go. He was on me in an instant, thrusting me flat down against my pillows. "So," he said silkily, his hand pressed down upon my collarbone, pinning me easily to the bed. It felt as though my heart was thumping back and forth between my breastbone and my back, each beat shaking me. He plucked the book away with a hand. At least I wasn't stupid enough to keep trying to hold on to it anymore, and tossed it with an easy flip so it landed upon the small table. "Agnieszka, was it? Agnieszka of Dvernik." He seemed to want an answer. "Yes," I whispered.
"Agnieszka," he murmured, bending low towards me, and I realized he meant to kiss me. I was terrified, and yet half wanting him to do it and have it over with, so I wouldn't have to be so afraid, and then he didn't at all. He said, bent so close, I could see my eyes reflected in his, "Tell me, dear Agnieszka, where are you really from? Did the Falcon send you? Or perhaps even the king himself?"
I stopped staring in terror at his mouth and darted my eyes towards his. What? I said.
"I will find out," he said. "However skillful your master's spell, it will have holes in it. Your family," he sneered the word, "may think they remember you, but they won't have all the things of a child's life. A pair of mittens, or a worn-out cap, a collection of broken toys. I won't find those things in your house, will I?"
"All my toys were broken?" I said helplessly, seizing on the only part of this I even understood at all. "Yes? All my clothes were always worn out. Our rag bag is all them."
He shoved me hard against the bed and bent low. "Don't dare lie to me," he hissed. "I will tear the truth out of your throat."
His fingers were resting on my neck. His leg was on the bed, between mine. In a great gulp of terror, I put my hands on his chest and shoved with all my body against the bed and heaved us both off it. We fell heavily together to the ground, him beneath me, and I was up like a rabbit, scrambling off him and running for the door. I fled for the stairs. I don't know where I thought I was going. I couldn't have gotten out the front door, and there was nowhere else to go, but I ran anyway. I scrambled down two flights, and as his steps pursuing me came on, I flung myself into the dim laboratory with all its hissing fumes and smoke.
I crawled away desperately under the tables into a dark corner behind a high cabinet and pulled my legs in towards me. I'd closed the door behind me, but that didn't seem to keep him from knowing where I'd gone. He opened it and looked into the room, and I saw him over the edge of one table, his cold and angry eye between two beakers of glass, his face painted in shades of green by the fires. He came with a steady, unhurried step around the table, and as he rounded the end, I darted forward, scrambling the other way, trying for the door. I had some thought of locking him in, but I jarred the narrow shelf against the wall. One of the stoppered jars struck my back, rolled off, and smashed on the floor at my feet. Gray smoke billowed up around me and into my nose and mouth, choking me, stealing me. It stung in my eyes, and I couldn't blink. I couldn't reach up to rub them, my arms refusing to answer. The coughs caught in my throat and stopped. My whole body froze slowly into place, still in a crouch on the floor. But I didn't feel afraid anymore, and after a moment, not even uncomfortable. I was somehow at once endlessly heavy and weightless, distant. I heard the dragon's footsteps very faintly and far off as he came and stood over me, and I didn't care what he would do. He stood there looking down at me with cold impatience. I didn't try to guess what he would do. I could neither think nor wonder. The world was very gray and still.
"No," he said after a moment. "No, you can't possibly be a spy."
He turned and left me there for some time. I couldn't have told you how long. It could have been an hour, or a week, or a year, though later I learned it had been only half a day. Then at last he returned, with a displeased, set look to his mouth. He held up a small, raggedy thing that had once been a piglet, knitted of wool and stuffed with straw, before I had dragged it behind me through the woods for the first 7 years of my life.
"So," he said, "no spy, only a witling."
Then he laid his hand on my head and said,
"Tezavon tahosh, tezavon tahosh kivi, kanzon lehush."
He didn't so much recite the words as chant them, almost like a song, and as he spoke, color and time and breath came back into the world. My head came free, and I shied out from under his hand. The stone was slowly fading out of my flesh. My arms came loose, flailing for a grip on anything, while my still stone legs held me locked in place. He caught my wrists, so when I finally came loose all the way, I was held by his hand, with no chance of flight. I didn't try to run, though. My suddenly free thoughts ran around in a dozen directions, as though they were catching up with lost time. But it seemed to me he might have just left me stone if he'd wanted to do something terrible to me, and at least he had stopped thinking me some sort of spy. I didn't understand why he thought anyone would have wanted to spy on him, much less the king. He was the king's wizard, wasn't he?
"And now you'll tell me. What were you doing?" he said.
His eyes were still suspicious and cold and glittering. "I only wanted a book to read," I said. I didn't think there was any harm."
"And you happened to take Luth Summoning off the shelf for a little reading?" he said, cuttingly sarcastic. "And merely by chance?"
Until perhaps my alarmed and blank look convinced him, and he halted and looked at me with unconcealed irritation.
"What an unequaled gift for disaster you have."
Then he scowled down, and I followed his look to the shards of the glass jar around our feet. He hissed his breath out between his teeth and said abruptly,
"Clean that up, and then come to the library. And don't touch anything else."
He stalked away, leaving me to go hunt out some rags from the kitchens to pick up the glass with and a bucket. I washed the floor as well though there wasn't a trace of anything spilled, as though the magic had burned off like the liquor on a pudding. I kept stopping and lifting my hand up from the stone floor to turn it over front and back, making sure the stone wasn't creeping back up my fingertips. I couldn't help but wonder why he had a jar of that on his shelf, and whether he'd ever used it on someone else. Someone who had become a statue somewhere, standing with fixed eyes, time eddying past them. I shuddered. I was very, very careful not to touch anything else in the room. The book I'd taken was back up on the shelf when, at last, I girded myself and went into the library. He was pacing, his own book on its small table, thrust aside and neglected. And when I came in, he scowled at me again. I looked down. My skirt was marked with wet tracks from the mopping, and it had been too short to begin with, barely covering my knees. The sleeves of my shift were worse. I'd got some egg on the ends that morning, making his breakfast, and had singed the elbow a little, getting the toast off before it burned.
"We'll begin with that, then," the dragon said. "I needn't be offended every time I have to look at you."
I shut my mouth on apologies. If I began to apologize for being untidy, I'd be apologizing the rest of my life. I could tell from only a few days in the tower that he loved beautiful things. Even his legions of books were none of them exactly alike. Their leather bindings in different colors, their clasps and hinges of gold, and sometimes even dotted with small chips of jewels. Anything that anyone might rest their eyes on, whether a small-blown glass cup upon the windowsill here in the library, or the painting in my room, was beautiful and set aside in its own place where it might shine without distractions. I was a glaring blot on the perfection. But I didn't care. I didn't feel I owed him beauty. He beckoned me over, impatiently, and I took a wary step towards him. He took my hands and crossed them over my chest, fingertips on each opposite shoulder, and said, "Now, Vanastalem." I stared at him in mute rebellion. The word, when he said it, rang in my ears just like the other spell he'd used me for. I could feel it wanting to come into my mouth, to drain away my strength. He caught me by the shoulder, his fingers gripping painfully hard. I felt the heat of each one penetrating through my shirt.
"I may have to put up with incompetence. I won't tolerate spinelessness," he said. "Say it."
I remembered being stone. What else could he do to me? I trembled and said, very soft, as if whispering could keep it from taking hold of me, "Vanastalem." My strength welled up through my body and fountained out of my mouth, and where it left me, a trembling in the air began and went curling down around my body in a spiraling path. I sank to the ground, gasping, in strangely vast skirts of rustling silk, green and russet brown. They pooled around my waist and swamped my legs, endless. My head bowed forward on my neck, under the weight of a curved headdress, a veil spilling down my back, lace picked out with flowers in gold thread. I stared dully at the dragon's boots, the tooled leather of them. There were curling vines embossed upon them.
"Look at you, and over a nothing of a spell again," he said over me, sounding exasperated with his own handiwork. "At least your appearance is improved. See if you can keep yourself in a decent state from now on. Tomorrow, we'll try another."
The boots turned and walked away from me. He sat down in his chair, I think, and went back to his reading. I don't know for certain. After a while, I crawled out of the library on my hands and knees, in that beautiful dress, without ever lifting my head. The next few weeks blurred into one another. Every morning I woke a little before dawn and lay in my bed, while my window brightened, trying to think of some way to escape. Every morning, having failed, I carried his breakfast tray to the library, and he cast another spell with me. If I hadn't been able to keep myself neat enough, usually I hadn't, he used vanastalam upon me first, and then a second spell too. All my homespun dresses were vanishing one after another, and the unwieldy elaborate dresses dotted my bedroom like small mountains, so heavy with brocade and embroidery that they half stood up without me inside them. I could barely writhe my way out from under the skirts at bedtime, and the awful bone stays beneath them squeezed in my breath. The aching fog never left me. After each morning, I crept shattered back to my chamber. I suppose the dragon got his own dinner, because I certainly did nothing for him. I lay on my bed until supper time, when usually I was able to creep back downstairs and get a simple meal, driven more by my own hunger than any concern for his needs. The worst of it was not understanding. Why was he using me this way? At night, before drowning in sleep, I imagined all the worst out of tales and fairy stories, vampires and incubi drinking the life out of maidens, and swore in terror that in the morning I would find a way out. Of course I never did. My only comfort was that I wasn't the first. I told myself he'd done this to all those other girls before me, and they had come through it. It wasn't much comfort. 10 years seemed to me forever. But I grasped at any thought that could ease my misery even a little. He gave me no comfort himself. He was irritated with me every time I came into his library, even on the few days that I managed to keep myself in good order, as though I were coming to annoy and interrupt him, instead of him tormenting and using me. And when he had finished working his magic through me and left me crumpled on the floor, he would scowl down at me and call me useless. One day, I tried to keep away entirely. I thought if I left his meal early, he might forget about me for a day. I laid his breakfast as dawn broke, then hurried away and hid in the back of the kitchens. But promptly at 7, one of his wisp things, the ones I'd sometimes seen floating down the spindle towards the wood, came gliding down the stairs. Seen close, it was a misshapen soap bubble thing, rippling and shifting, almost invisible, unless the light caught on its iridescent skin. The wisp went bobbing in and out of corners, until at last it reached me and came to hover over my knees insistently. I stared up at it from my huddle and saw my own face looking back in ghostly outline. Slowly I unfolded myself and followed the wisp back up to the library, where he set aside his book and glared at me.
"As happy as I would be to forego the very doubtful pleasure of watching you flop about like an exhausted eel over the least cantrip," he bit out. "We've already seen the consequences of leaving you to your own devices. How much of a slattern have you made yourself today?"
I'd been making a desperate effort to keep myself tidy, so I could at least avoid the first spell. Today, I had only acquired a few small smudges making breakfast, and one streak of oil. I held a fold of my dress shut around that. But he was looking at me with distaste anyway, and when I followed the line of his gaze, I saw to my dismay that while I had been hiding in the back of the kitchens, I had evidently picked up a cobweb. The one cobweb in all the tower, I suppose, which was now trailing from the back of my skirt like a thin, ragged veil. "Vanastalem," I repeated with him, dully resigned, and watched the riotously beautiful wave of orange and yellow silk come sweeping up from the floor to surround me like leaves blown down an autumn path. I swayed, breathing heavily, as he sat down again.
"Now then," he said.
He had set a stack of books upon the table, and with a shove he toppled them over into a loose and scattered heap.
"To order them, Darend et al.
He waved his hand at the table. Darend et al? I mumbled along with him, and the spell came strangling out of my throat. The books on the table shuddered, and one after another lifted and spun into place like unnatural jeweled birds in their bindings of red and yellow and blue and brown. This time I didn't sink to the floor. I only gripped the edge of the table with both hands and leaned against it.
He was frowning at the stack. "What idiocy is this?" he demanded. "There is no order here. Look at this."
I looked at the books. They were piled into a single stack neatly enough, with like colors next to each other.
"Color?" he said, his voice rising. "By color? You!"
He was as furious with me as if it had been my fault. Maybe it did something to his magic when he pulled strength from me to fuel it.
"Oh, get out!" he snarled,
and I hurried away, full of resentful secret delight. Oh, I was glad if I was spoiling his magic somehow. I had to stop halfway up the stairs to catch my breath inside the stays, but when I did, I realized abruptly that I wasn't crawling. I was still tired, but the fog hadn't descended. I even managed to climb the rest of the way to the top of the stairs without another pause, and though I fell onto my bed and drowsed away half of the day, at least I didn't feel like a mindless husk. The fog lifted more and more as the next few weeks passed, as though practice was making me stronger, better able to bear whatever he was doing to me. The sessions began little by little to be not pleasant, but not terrifying, only a tiresome chore, like having to scrub pots in cold water. I could sleep at night again, and my spirit began to recover too. Every day I felt better, and every day more angry. I couldn't get back into the ridiculous gowns in any kind of reasonable way. I tried, but I couldn't even reach the buttons and laces in the back, and I usually had to burst threads and crumple the skirts even to get out of them. So every night, I shoved them into a piled-up heap out of the way, and every morning I would put on another of the homespun ones, and try and keep as tidy as I could, and every few days he would lose patience with my untidiness and change that one too. And now I had reached the last of my homespun gowns. I held that last gown of plain, undyed wool in my hands, feeling like it was a rope I was clinging to. And then, in a burst of defiance, I left it on my bed and pulled myself into the green and russet gown. I couldn't fasten the buttons in back, so I took the long veil from the headdress, wound it twice around my waist, and made a knot, just barely good enough to keep the whole thing from falling off me, and marched downstairs to the kitchens. I didn't even try to keep myself clean this time. I carried the tray up to the library, defiantly bespattered with egg and bacon grease and splotches of tea, my hair in snarls, looking like some sort of mad noblewoman who'd run off to the woods from a ball. Of course it didn't last long. As soon as I resentfully said Vanastalem along with him, his magic seized me and shook off my stains, squashed me back into stays, piled my hair back up on my head, and left me once again, looking like a doll for some princess to play with. But I felt happier that morning than I had in weeks, and from then on it became my private defiance. I wanted him to be bitterly annoyed every time he looked at me, and he rewarded me with every incredulous scowl.
"How do you do this to yourself?" he asked me, almost marveling, one day when I wandered in with a clump of rice pudding on top of my head.
I had accidentally hit a spoon with my elbow and flung some into the air, and a huge red streak of jam going all the way down my front of beautiful cream silk. The last homespun dress I kept in my dresser. Every day after he had done with me, I went upstairs. I would wrestle my way out of the ball gown, drag my hair out of the nets and headdresses, scattering jeweled pins on the floor, and then I would put on the soft, well-worn letnik and a homespun smock, which I kept washed and clean by hand. And then I went down to the kitchens to make my own bread, and I rested by the warm fireplace while it baked, careless of a few smudges of ashen flour on my skirts. I began to have enough energy for boredom once again. I didn't even think of taking another book from the library, though. Instead, I went for a needle, much as I loathed to sew. As long as I was going to be drained to the belly every morning to make dresses, I thought I might as well tear them apart and make something less useless of them. Sheets, perhaps, or handkerchiefs. The mending basket had stood untouched inside the box in my room. There was nothing in the castle to mend but my own clothes, which until now I had been sullenly glad to leave torn. But when I opened it, I found tucked inside a single scrap of paper, written on with a bit of stubby charcoal, the hand of my friend from the kitchen. "You are afraid. Don't be. He won't touch you. He will only want you to make yourself handsome. He won't think to give you anything, but you can take a fine dress from one of the guest chambers and make it over to fit you. When he summons you, sing to him or tell him a story. He wants company, but not much of it. Bring his meals and avoid him when you can, and he will ask nothing more." How priceless those words would have been to me if I had opened the mending basket and found them that first night. Now I stood holding the note, shaking with the memory of his voice overlaid on my halting one, dragging spells and strength out of me, draping me in silks and velvet. I had been wrong. He hadn't done any of this to the other women at all. Chapter 3. I huddled in my bed all that night without sleeping, desperate all over again. But getting out of the tower didn't become easier just because I wanted it more. I did go to the great doors the next morning and tried for the first time to lift the enormous bar across them, no matter how ridiculous the attempt. But of course, I couldn't budge it a quarter of an inch. Down in the pantry, using a long-handled pot for a lever, I pried up the great iron cap that covered the refuse pit and looked down. Deep below, a fire gleamed. There was no escape there for me. I pushed the iron lid back into place with an effort, and then I searched all along the walls with both my palms into every dark corner, looking for some opening, some entry. But if there was one, I didn't find it. And then morning was spilling down the stairs behind me, an unwelcome golden light. I had to make the breakfast and carry the tray up to my doom. As I laid the food out, the plate of eggs, the toast, the preserves, I looked over, and looked over again, at the long, steel-gleaming butcher's knife with its handle jutting out of the block towards me. I had used it to cut meat. I knew how quick it was. My parents raised a pig every year. I'd helped at butchering time, held the bucket for the pig's blood, but the thought of putting a knife into a man was something else, unimaginable. So I didn't imagine it. I only put the knife on the tray and went upstairs. When I came into the library, he was standing by the windowsill with his back to me and his shoulders stiff with irritation. I mechanically put out the dishes, one after another, until there was nothing left but the tray and the knife. My dress was splattered with oatmeal and egg. In the moment he would say, "Finish with that," he said, "and go upstairs." "What?" I said blankly. The knife was still under its napkin, drowning out all my other thoughts, and it took a moment for me to understand I'd been reprieved. "Are you grown suddenly deaf?" he snapped. "Stop fussing with those plates and take yourself off, and keep to your rooms until I summon you again." My dress was stained and crumpled, a ruin of tangled ribbons, but he hadn't even turned to look at me. I snatched up the tray and fled the room, needing no more excuse. I ran up the stairs, feeling almost as if I were flying, without the terrible weariness dragging at my heels. I went into my room and shut the door
and tore off my silken finery, put back on my homespun, and sank down on the bed, hugging myself with relief, like a child who'd escaped a whipping. And then I saw the tray discarded on the floor, the knife lying bare and gleaming.
Oh, what a fool I'd been, even to think about it. He was my lord. If by some horrible chance I had killed him, I would surely be put to death for it, and like as not my parents along with me. Murder was no escape at all. Better to just throw myself out the window. I even turned and looked out the window, miserably. And then I saw what the dragon had been watching with such distaste. There was a cloud of dust on the road, coming to the tower. It wasn't a wagon, but a great covered carriage, almost like a house on wheels, harnessed to a team of steaming horses, with two horsemen riding before the driver, all of them in coats of gray and brilliant green. Four more horsemen followed it, in similar coats. The carriage drew up outside the great doors. There was a green crest on it, a monster with many heads, and all the outriders and guards came rolling down off their horses and went into an enormous bustle of work. They all flinched away a little when the tower doors swung lightly open, those huge doors I couldn't even shift. I craned my head to peer down and saw the dragon step out from the doors alone, onto the threshold. A man came ducking out of the belly of the carriage, tall, golden-haired, broad-shouldered, with a long cloak of the same brilliant green. He jumped down over the steps which had been put out for him, took with one hand the sword which another of his servants held across the palms, and strode quickly between his men and up to the door, even as he belted it on with no hesitation.
"I loathe a coach more than a chimera," he said to the dragon,
clear enough that I heard his voice rising to my window over the snorting, stamping horses.
"A wick shut up in the thing. Why can't you ever come to court?"
"Your Highness will have to forgive me," the dragon said coldly. "My duties here occupy me." I was leaning out far enough by then. I might have easily fallen out just by accident, with all my fear and misery forgot. The king of Polnia had two sons, but Crown Prince Zygmunt was nothing but a sensible young man. He had been well-educated and had married the daughter of some reigning count in the north, which had brought us an ally and a port. They had already assured the succession with a boy and a girl for spare. He was supposedly an excellent administrator and would be an excellent king, and no one cared anything about him. Prince Marek was enormously more satisfying. I had heard at least a dozen stories and songs of how he had slain the Vandalous Hydra, none of them alike, but all of them, I was assured, true in every particular. And besides that, he had killed at least 3 or 4 or 9 giants in the last war against Rossia. He had even ridden out to try and kill a real dragon once, only it had turned out to be some peasants pretending to have been attacked by a dragon and hiding the sheep they claimed it had eaten to get out of tax. And he hadn't even executed them, but had chastised their lord for levying too high a tax. He went into the tower with the dragon, and the doors closed behind them. The prince's men began encamping on the level field before the doors. I turned back into my small room and paced the floor in circles. At last, I went and crept down the stairwell to try and listen, edging down until I heard their voices drifting out of the library. I couldn't catch more than one word in 5, but they were speaking of the wars with Rossia and of the wood. I didn't try very hard to eavesdrop. I didn't much care what they were talking about. Far more important to me was the faint hope of rescue stirring. Whatever the dragon was doing to me, this horror of life draining, it was surely against the king's law. He'd told me to keep away, to keep out of sight. What if that wasn't only because I was a discreditable mess, which he could have repaired with a word, but because he didn't want the prince to know what he was doing? What if I threw myself on the prince's mercy, and he took me away? enough,
Prince Marek said, his voice breaking in on my thoughts. The words had come clearer, as if he was moving closer to the door. He sounded angry.
You and my father and Zygmunt, all of you, bleating like sheep. No, enough. I don't mean to let this rest.
I hastily flew back up the stairwell on bare feet, as noiseless as I could make them. The guest chambers were on the third floor, the one between mine and the library. I sat at the top of the stairwell, listening to their boots on the steps below, until the sounds died away. I wasn't sure I had it in me to disobey the dragon directly. If he caught me trying to go knock on the prince's door, he'd surely do something terrible to me. But he was already doing something terrible to me. Kasha would have seized the chance, I was sure. If she'd been here, she would go and open the door and kneel at the prince's feet and beg him for rescue, not like a frightened, blubbering child, but like a maiden out of the stories. I went back to my room and practiced the scene, murmuring words under my breath while the sun sank down. And when at last it was dark and late, I crept down the stairs with my heart pounding. But I was still afraid. First I went down and looked to make sure the lights were out in the library and in the laboratory. The dragon wasn't awake. On the third floor, a dim fire's glow showed orange beneath the first guest chamber, and I couldn't see anything of the dragon's bedroom door at all. It was lost in the shadows at the end of the hall. But still, I hesitated on the landing, and then I went down to the kitchens instead. I told myself I was hungry. I ate a few mouthfuls of bread and cheese to fortify myself, while I stood shivering in front of the fire, and then I went back upstairs. All the way upstairs, back to my room. I couldn't make myself really imagine it. Me at the prince's door, me kneeling and making a graceful speech. I wasn't Kasha, wasn't anyone special. I'd only burst into tears and look like a lunatic, and he'd probably throw me out or worse, call the dragon to have me properly chastised. Why would he believe me? A peasant girl in a homespun smock, a low servant in a dragon's house, waking him in the middle of the night with a wild story of the great wizard tormenting me. I went desolately back into my room and stopped short. Prince Marek was standing in the middle of the chamber, studying the painting. He'd pulled down the cover I'd put over it. He turned around and looked me over, with a doubtful expression.
My Lord Highness?
I said, but not really. The words came out in such a whisper, he couldn't have heard them, except as an inarticulate noise. He didn't seem to care. Well, he said, you aren't one of his beauties, are you? He crossed the room, barely two steps needed. He made it seem smaller by being there. He put his hand under my chin, turned my face side to side, inspecting it. I stared up at him dumbly. He was strange to be so close to, overwhelming. Taller than I was, broad with the weight of a man who nearly lived in armor, handsome as a portrait, and clean-shaven, freshly bathed, his golden hair was dark and damply curling at the base of his neck. But perhaps you've some particular skill, sweet, that makes up for it. That's his usual line, isn't it? He didn't sound cruel, only teasing, and his smile down at me was conspiratorial. I didn't feel wounded at all, only dazed from so much attention, as though I'd already been saved without having to say a word. And then he laughed and kissed me and reached efficiently for my skirts. I started like a fish trying to jump out of a net and struggled against him. It was like struggling against the tower doors, impossible. He scarcely even noticed me trying. He laughed again and kissed my throat. Don't worry, he can't object, he said, as though that was my only reason to protest. He's still my father's vassal, even if he likes to stay out here in the hinterlands, lording it over you all alone. It's not like he was taking pleasure in overcoming me. I was still mute, and my resistance was more confused batting at him, half wondering. Surely he couldn't. Prince Marek couldn't. The hero. Surely he couldn't even really want me. I didn't scream. I didn't plead, and I think he scarcely imagined that I would resist. I suppose in an ordinary noble house, some more than willing scullery maid would already have crept into his bedchamber and saved him the trouble of going looking. For that matter, I'd probably have been willing myself if he'd asked me outright and given me enough time to get over my surprise and answer him. I struggled more by reflex than because I wanted to reject him. But he did overcome me. Then I began to be really afraid, wanting only to get away. I pushed at his hands and said, "Prince, I don't, please, wait," in disjointed bursts. And though he might not have wanted resistance, when he met it, he cared nothing. He only grew impatient. "There, there, all right," he said, as though I were a horse to be reined in and made calm, while he pinned my hand by my side. My homespun dress was tied up with a sash in a simple bow. He already had it loose, and then he dragged up my skirts. I was trying to thrust my skirts back down, push him away, drag myself free. Useless. He held me with such casual strength. And then he reached for his own hose, and I said aloud, desperate, without thinking, "Vanastalem!" Power shouted out of me. Crusted pearls and whalebone closed up beneath his hands like armor, and he jerked his hands off me and stepped back as a wall of velvet skirts fell rustling between us. I caught myself on a wall trembling and struggling to get my breath while he stared at me. And then he said, in a very different voice, a tone I couldn't understand, "You're a witch." I backed from him like a wary animal, my head spinning. I couldn't get my breath properly. The gown had saved me, but the stays were strangling tight, the skirts dragging and heavy, as though they'd deliberately made themselves impossible to remove. He came towards me more slowly, a hand outstretched, saying, "Listen to me." But I hadn't the least intention of listening. I snatched up the breakfast tray, still sitting atop my dresser, and swung it wildly at his head. The edge of it clanged loudly against his skull and knocked him staggering sideways. I gripped it with both hands and lifted it up and swung again and again, blindly desperate. I was still swinging when the door burst open and the dragon was there, in a long, magnificent dressing gown flung over his night shift, his eyes savage. He took one step into the room and halted, staring. I halted too, panting, the tray still upraised mid-swing. The prince had sunk to his knees before me. A maze of blood was running down over his face, bloody bruises across his forehead. His eyes were closed. He fell over onto the floor before me, unconscious with a thump. The dragon took in the scene, looked at me, and said, "You idiot! What have you done now?" We heaved the prince onto my narrow bed together. His face was already blackening with bruises. The tray upon the floor was dented badly with the curve of his skull. "Splendid," the dragon said through his teeth, inspecting him. The prince's eyes were staring and strange, dull, when he lifted their lids, and his arm lifted, fell limply back to the cot, and dangled off the side. I stood watching, panting against the bodice, my desperate fury gone and only horror left. As strange as that may sound, I wasn't only afraid of what would happen to me. I didn't want the prince to die. He was still half in my head as the shining hero of legend, all confusedly tangled up with the beast who'd just been pawing at me.
He's not...
"If you don't want a man dead, don't bludgeon him over the head repeatedly," the dragon snapped. "Go down to the laboratory and bring me the yellow elixir in a clear flask from the shelf in the back. Not the red one, and not the violet one, and try, if possible, not to break it as you bring it up the stairs, unless you want to try and persuade the king that your virtue was worth the life of his son."
He laid his hands on the prince's head and began to chant softly, words that shivered along my spine. I ran for the stairs, clutching my skirts up against me. I brought the elixir back up in only moments, panting with haste and the confinement of my stays, and found the dragon still working. He didn't interrupt his chanting, only held a hand out towards me impatiently, beckoning sharply. I laid the flask in his hand. With the fingers of one hand, he worked out the cork and tipped the swallow into the prince's mouth. The smell of it was horrible, like rotting fish. I nearly choked with nausea just from standing nearby. The dragon shoved the flask and cork back at me without even looking, and I had to hold my breath to close it. He was clamping the prince's jaw shut with both hands. Even unconscious and wounded, the prince jerked and tried to spit. The elixir was glowing somehow from inside his mouth, so bright that I could see his jaw and teeth outlined like a skull. I managed to shut the flask again without retching, and then sprang to help. I pinched the prince's nose shut, and after a moment, he finally swallowed. The brilliant glow went down his throat and into his belly. I could make it out still traveling all throughout his body, a light underneath his clothes, thinning out as it branched away into his arms and legs, until at last it died away too dim to see. The dragon let go of Prince's head and stopped chanting the spell. He sagged back against the wall with his eyes shut. He looked drained, as I had never seen him before. I stood hovering anxiously over the bed, over both of them, and finally I blurted, "Will he?"
"No thanks to you," the dragon said.
But that was good enough. I let myself sink to the ground in my heap of cream velvet and buried my head on the bed in my arms, sheathed in embroidered golden lace.
"And now you're going to blubber, I suppose," the dragon said over my head. "What were you thinking? Why did you put yourself into that ludicrous dress if you didn't want to seduce him?"
"It was better than staying in one he tore off me," I cried, lifting my head, not in tears at all. I had spent all my tears by then, and all I had left was anger. "I didn't choose to be in this." I stopped. A heavy fold of silk caught up in my hands, staring at it. The dragon had been nowhere near. He hadn't worked any magic, cast any spell.
"What have you done to me?" I whispered.
"He said, he called me a witch.
You've made me a witch." The dragon snorted. "If I could make witches, I certainly wouldn't choose a half-wit peasant girl as my material. I haven't done anything to you, but try and drum a few miserable cantrips into your nearly impenetrable skull."
He levered himself up off the bed with a hiss of weariness, struggling, not unlike the way I'd struggled in those terrible weeks while he taught me magic. Still on my knees, I stared up at him, bewildered, and yet unwillingly beginning to believe. "But then, why would you teach me?"
"I would have been delighted to leave you moldering in your coin-sized village, but my options were painfully limited." To my blank look, he scowled. "Those with the gift must be taught. The king's law requires it. In any case, it would have been idiotic of me to leave you sitting there like a ripe plum, until something came along out of the wood and ate you, and made itself into a truly remarkable horror."
While I flinched away appalled from this idea, he turned his scowl on the prince, who had just groaned a little and stirred in his sleep. He was beginning to wake, lifting a groggy hand to rub at his face. I scrambled up to my feet and edged away from the bed in alarm, closer towards the dragon.
"Here," the dragon said. "Kalikual. It's better than beating paramours into insensibility."
He looked at me expectantly. I stared at him and at the slowly rousing prince and back. "If I wasn't a witch," I said, "if I wasn't a witch, would you let me?"
Could I go home? Couldn't you take it out of me?
He was silent. I was used to the contradiction of his wizard's face by now, young and old together. For all his years, he only had folds at the corners of his eyes, a single crease between his brows, sharp frown lines around his mouth, nothing else. He moved like a young man, and if people grew milder or kinder with age, he certainly hadn't. But for a moment now, his eyes were purely old and very strange.
No, he said,
and I believed him.
Then he shook it off and pointed. Turning, I found the prince pushing himself up onto his elbow and blinking at us both, still dazed and unknowing. But even as I looked, the spark of recognition came back into his face, remembering me.
I whispered, Kalikual.
The power rushed out of me. Prince Marek sank back down against the pillows, eyes closing back into sleep. I staggered over to the wall and slid down it to the floor. The butcher knife was still there, lying on the ground where it had fallen down. I picked it up and at last used it to cut through the dress and the laces of my stays. My dress gaped open all along my side, but at least I could breathe. I lay back against the wall with my eyes shut for a moment. Then I looked up at the dragon, who had turned away in impatience from my fatigue. He was looking down at the prince with irritation. "Won't his men ask for him in the morning?" I said.
"Did you imagine you were going to keep Prince Marek locked up, fast asleep in my tower indefinitely?" the dragon said over his shoulder.
"But then, when he wakes," I said, then stopped and asked, "could you? Can you make him forget?"
"Oh, certainly," the dragon said. "He won't at all notice anything peculiar if he wakes up with a splitting headache and an enormous gap in his memory to go with it."
"What if..." I struggled back up to my feet, still clutching the knife. "What if he remembers something else, just going to bed in his own room?"
"Try not to be stupid," the dragon said. "You said you didn't seduce him, so he came up here of his own intention. When was that intention formed? Merely tonight, as he already lay in his bed? Or was he thinking of it along the road? A warm bed, welcoming arms. Yes, I realize yours weren't. You've provided sufficient evidence to the contrary," he snapped when I would have protested. "For all we know, he meant to do it even before he set out. A calculated sort of insult."
I remembered the prince speaking of the dragon's usual line, as though he had thought of it beforehand, as though he'd planned it almost. "To insult you?" I said.
"He supposes I take women to force them to whore for me," the dragon said. "Most of those courtiers do. They'd do as much themselves if they had the chance. So I imagine he thought of it as cuckolding me. He would have been delighted to spread it around the court, I'm sure. It's the sort of thing the Magnati waste their time caring about."
He spoke disdainfully, but he'd certainly been angry enough when he came storming into the room.
"Why would he want to insult you?" I timidly asked. "Didn't he come to ask you for some magic?"
"No, he came to enjoy the view of the wood," the dragon said. "Of course he came for magic, and I sent him about his business, which is hacking at enemy knights and not meddling in things he scarcely understands," he snorted. "He's begun to believe his own troubadours. He wanted to try and get back the queen."
"But the queen is dead," I said, confused. That had been the start of the wars. Crown Prince Vasily of Rossiya had come to visit Polnia on an embassy, nearly 20 years ago now. He'd fallen in love with Queen Hanna, and they'd run away together. And when the king's soldiers had drawn near on their trail, they'd fled into the wood. That was the end of the story. No one went into the wood and came out again, at least not whole and themselves. Sometimes they came out blind and screaming. Sometimes they came out twisted,
and so misshapen, they couldn't be recognized. And worst of all, sometimes they came out with their own faces, but murder behind them. Something gone dreadfully wrong within. The queen and Prince Vasily hadn't come out at all. The king of Polonia blamed Rosia's heir for abducting her. The king of Rosia had blamed Polonia for his heir's death. And since then, we'd had one war after another, broken only by occasional truces and a few short-lived treaties. Here in the valley, we shook our heads over the story. Everyone agreed it had all been the Wood's doing from the start. The queen with two small children to run away? To start a war with her own husband? Their own courtship had been famous. There had been a dozen songs of their wedding. My mother had sung me one of them, the part she remembered. None of the traveling singers would perform them anymore, of course. The Wood had to be behind it. Perhaps someone had poisoned the two of them with water taken from the river, just where it went into the Wood. Perhaps some courtier traveling along the mountain pass to Rosia had accidentally spent a night under the dark trees near the edge and gone back to the court with something else inside him. We knew it was the Wood. But that didn't make a difference. Queen Hannah was still gone, and she'd gone with the Prince of Rosia. And so we were all at war, and the Wood crept a little farther into both realms every year, feeding on their deaths and all the deaths since then. "No," the dragon said, "the queen's not dead. She's still in the Wood." I stared at him. He sounded matter-of-fact, certain, although I'd never heard of anything like it. But it was enough of a horror for me to believe it. To be trapped in the Wood for 20 years, imprisoned endlessly in some way, it was the kind of thing the Wood would do. The dragon shrugged and waved a hand at the prince. There is no getting her out again, and he'd only start something worse by going in, but he won't hear it. He snorted. He thinks killing a day-old hydra has made him a hero. None of the songs had ever mentioned the Vandalous Hydra being one day old. It diminished the story more than a little. "In any case," the dragon said, "I suppose he does feel aggrieved. Lords and princes loathe magic anyway, and all the more for how badly they need it. Yes, some petty revenge of that sort is the most likely." I could easily believe it. And I did grasp the dragon's point. If the prince had meant to enjoy the dragon's companion, whoever that girl might be, I felt a surge of indignation, thinking of Kasha in my place, without even unwanted magic to save her. Then he wouldn't have simply gone to bed. That memory wouldn't fit neatly into his head, like a wrong puzzle piece. "However," the dragon added, in a tone of mild condescension, as if I were a puppy that had managed not to chew a shoe, "it's not an entirely useless idea. I ought to be able to alter his memory in the other direction." He raised a hand and, puzzled, I said, "The other direction?" "I'll give him a memory of enjoying your favors," the dragon said, "full of suitable enthusiasm on your part and the satisfaction of making a fool of me. I'm sure he won't have any difficulty swallowing that." "What?" I said. "You'll have him..." "No. He'll... "Do you mean to tell me you care what he thinks of you?" the dragon demanded, an eyebrow rising. "If he thinks I've lain with him, what's to stop him from wanting it again?" I said. The dragon waved a dismissive hand. "I'll make it an unpleasant memory. All elbows and shrill, maidenly giggling. Over quickly. Or do you have any better notions?" he added waspish. "Perhaps you'd rather he woke up remembering you doing your best to murder him?" So the next morning, I had the deeply wretched experience of seeing Prince Marek stop outside the tower doors to look up to my window and blow me a cheerful and indiscreet kiss. I'd been watching only to be sure he actually left. It took nearly all the caution left in me not to throw something down at his head and I don't mean a token of my regard. But the dragon hadn't been wrong to be wary, even